everyone, welcome to Project Unlaced. I have a very special guest and I am so excited to have this conversation. We have Emily. She is an expert on periods and we are so excited to have her today. So Emily, thank you so much for coming on today. I'm so excited.
Of course, my pleasure. When you sent the email to me asking to be a guest on this podcast, I was incredibly excited. I am always excited to talk about periods, to talk about where nutrition and health really come into that conversation. So I'm very much looking forward to what we'll chat about today.
Yeah, and I think these conversations are just so relevant today in diet culture. So kind of leading from diet culture, you weren't always like focused on menstrual health. It seemed like you were always kind of focused on like being a dietitian. So what inspired you to make this move and to especially focus on not being focused on diets and focusing more on like menstrual cycles?
Absolutely. So funny enough, at kind of my internship or residency, I guess either way is kind of correct to describe it, graduation, I was really interested in more intensive clinical work. So one of the areas, or two of the areas I really loved working in were the intensive care unit and the surgical units.
Interesting.
They were incredibly fast-paced. I loved the dietitians that I trained with. I loved the types of conditions and concerns that were coming through the collaborative care. You're right, menstrual health wasn't always on my radar. And when I graduated from my internship, I was very privileged. I do acknowledge that, that I had connections to a local family health team, a doctor's office in my local community. So I got to move home with my parents and my sisters, my family, and start working there as soon as I had moved home. And that was very general care. I did some additional training in smoking cessation counseling as well. So I did some of that work. And community outreach, so working with local childcare centers, local kind of food banks and other outreach organizations to talk about nutrition. And as I was getting more experience as a dietitian, I noticed I had a lot of interest and I would get really excited every time I was working with patients and clients around pregnancy or lactation or fertility. And I realized, you know what, I didn't actually get a lot of education in this area. I really need to learn more. And dietitians in Canada, especially, I'm in Ontario, don't have specialties. So there isn't a board certification for the area that I work in, which is more so reproductive medicine and gynecology. But I didn't want that to stop me from getting better in the area and having more of an expertise. And so that's what really drove me to move into that and make that the focus of the work that I do.
Oh, interesting. So you really had to like do that extra research like yourself to learn more about like menstrual health and reproduction.
Absolutely. I went on and I did graduate studies through the University of Alberta in sexual health education. So being able to talk in school environment, classroom environments about birth control and pregnancy, et cetera. And so that was really a kickstarter for my formal education in the area. I did go on later to do a course in embryology through the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. And then as part of our licensing requirements, we have to complete so many hours of continuing education and of various types. And so my primary continuing education, if there's anything that's menstrual health related, that's probably what's on my documentation in my continuing ed.
I just love how like you're really there to open up the conversation. I feel like a lot of like sexual health and menstrual cycles are so like stigmatized in our society and it's kind of like icky words. Mm-hmm. So I love that like you're able to say them and like that's not a word that needs to have a negative connotation to it. Like that's just part of life. So I love that, you know, you were willing to take that step and say, hey, I'm interested in this and I'm going to pursue it, even if there's not a direct path for me. Mm-hmm. Now, in 2020, you said that you started to notice like patterns of shame and confusion around especially women's health. Can you share more about like what you were seeing and what made you take action?
Definitely. I had a lot of women presenting to my office with lots of confusion around just anatomy. where things were located in the body. It was so memorable because it took me by surprise. I had a patient who came in and was talking about lower back pain, and she had said to her doctor reportedly, I'm concerned about my kidneys because, my lower back, and I have some family history of kidney issues. And she says to me, "Oh, my doctor told me that it couldn't be low back pain, or it had to be low back pain, but it couldn't be my kidneys because my kidneys, they're under my back bra strap. They're not in my low back." And I thought, that's not where the kidneys are located at all. They are very much in the low back. I'd have women coming into the office crying because they had gained a small amount of weight or their body composition hadn't changed, even though they were reporting they were eating almost nothing, and feeling a lot of pressure to get back to pre-baby weight if they had just recently had a baby. Or some of the most awful kind of situations. I had patients that were declined inpatient services for an eating disorder because they didn't look sick. And
Oh,
even just
wow.
general reproductive health questions, right? They come up as part of my assessments of, I'm starting to notice that I'm spotting while I'm taking birth control, or my periods have stopped, or they're really irregular, but I'm not pregnant. I'm taking tests. I don't know what's going on. Or I think I'm going through perimenopause, but I don't even really know what I'm supposed to be watching for. My periods are the same, but I just don't feel right. And this lined up at the same time with a change in my work in 2020. I was moved down into more of a part-time position instead of full-time. And over the course of trying to pick up some of those pieces, it was a surprising change for me. I saw an ad in a local community magazine for a women's health clinic that had recently opened. And so I decided, you know what? I think this is the universe telling me it's time to maybe get into this area. I'm doing all of this, reading and research and trying to learn more. Now I'm thinking about it that this might be the push. So I contacted them. I basically pitched what my position was and what I wanted to do. I wanted to focus in that area, the types of services I wanted to offer. And it went off without a hitch. And then I eventually moved into private practice in women's healthcare full time, along with some other virtual private practice opportunities in more eating disorder care and intuitive eating education. So it was very much seeing so much of this shame around the way the body was, or just confusion around how the body works, that made me, it clicked for me that, I've been thinking about this area and I'm seeing it, and I'm not happy with this is the way that it's going. I'm gonna fix this. There's a really great quote, "If not me, who? And if not now, when?" And that was my when, and I was the who.
I love that. And I think you're so right to call out the fact that so many of these issues, whether it is an eating disorder or like questions about like reproductive health or just the body in general, like so many of these things are missed or answered incorrectly by doctors. I know that I've seen that in my own journey where like I had a doctor when I was struggling the most with an eating disorder who actually praised for how skinny my
Oh,
body looked instead of raising
yeah.
red flags when clearly losing weight at a time when you're supposed to be going through puberty is bad. And also these misconceptions around periods, especially being an athlete, there's a lot of misconceptions around, not having your period is a
Absolutely.
sign of fitness. And that's why so many athletes are missed by doctors because they bring up, yeah, I'm 16 and not getting my period. Like, is that a problem? And the doctor says, no, like, you're a runner. That's okay. It just means you're
Right.
training like really hard right
Or
now.
even worse in those situations, "Oh, I'm a really high intensity athlete and I'm not getting my period. Well, let's just use a birth control and then you'll get a period regularly and it'll be fine." And completely missing the root problem being there should be something going on that might not be the best course of action for that person.
Exactly. You're definitely just like putting a blanket over it, and like now someone can't figure out that the root cause until years later because obviously they're not addressing like the hormones.
Exactly.
Definitely. So kind of speaking of this, I feel like we've been kind of touching on diet culture a little bit. So you started transitioning away from kind of this diet culture and the traditional weight loss model towards more of a holistic and intuitive approach. So what challenges did you face with that? Because I'm sure that there was a lot of barriers and a lot of people who are like, no, this is how we've always done it. And especially in diet culture with social media saying like, this is what you need to eat to lose weight. So how did you, make that shift? And what was that process like?
Yeah, you're right. It was a very difficult transition. Mostly, well, not mostly. I would say I give equal weight to two separate parts of it. One being that so much of dietetic education, the way that dietitians are trained, is in the weight-centric model, using weight as a marker of health status or using weight as an outcome measure when it comes to nutrition changes, exercise changes, etc. And so much of my education was based on using that as a part of care and offering it to people even if it was unprompted, right? So if I screened on a BMI, which has so many flaws to it, that it was high, that, you know, I was to start making recommendations to lower that number because of XYZ reasons, even if that person wasn't coming to me for that particular concern. So the challenge on that front was having the vocabulary and the skills to recognize all of the data we've been researching and gathering around a more weight inclusive or weight neutral model, and being able to communicate that more effectively to patients and understand what I had been doing was causing harm and that I could repair that and make changes as a practitioner. So finding that education and starting to implement it was definitely a barrier on my side of the equation. On the other side, definitely administration and my coworkers in my clinic position were pretty unhappy. You know, I was told, just do your job. You know, if you're not focusing on weight loss, what's the point? Why do we have a dietitian then? And I had at one point a coworker say, you know, it'll make Dr. So-and-so really angry if you're not providing some sort of weight loss service. And by that point, you know, I was already planning to transition out of that job. I'm pretty sure my response was, I don't really care what Dr. So-and-so thinks. It's my license. I get to do with it what I please, and follow, you know, my guidelines. I'm following the science. And I had, I think it was even the same doctor, make a really weird comment to me about my own body in the context of not providing that service. It was along the lines of, you know, you're young, you're attractive, you're thin. People would listen to you if you would just provide weight loss advice. So just keep that in mind. And I was so, it was so gross. I remember going home to my parents and being like, this person said this to me today and it made me really uncomfortable. It was gross.
Definitely a red flag. A
very big red flag. So they were both very supportive. They're like, yeah, no, that's not normal. That's not cool. So just, you know, if you have to get HR involved, like, we support you on that as your parents. And my team at one point wanted to do like a workplace wellness challenge where you do a before and after. And at this point I was mid transition to more weight inclusive care. And, you know, I'd said, I'm not taking a before and after. I have my own history of, disordered eating and I'm not comfortable with doing that. And they had to, you know, oh, you have to model that for the community. Like, we need the dietitian to do it or otherwise it's a waste. So I ended up doing everything else except all the measurements. I did the steps and I did the self-care time and they weren't entirely pleased with it, but I said, take it or leave it. That's all I'm doing. And I started learning everything I could about weight neutral, weight inclusive care. I tried to teach it in the workplace. I do lunch and learns. I amped up the way that I documented. I started reporting more informed consent practices around the risks of intentional weight loss. Having tough conversations in the lunchroom with my coworkers probably made me wildly unpopular with a lot of them, but whatever. I'm a spiteful woman. I don't care. And then eventually ended up leaving for a team that shared the same values and studied the same research and was willing to put in the same amount of work. So the barriers were definitely on both my end as a practitioner and the environment I worked on. It was a combination of building my skills and trying my best to improve the environment, but also recognizing that that place just wasn't for me anymore and finding somewhere else that was.
I think it's so interesting that you talk about the environment because I've definitely seen that in my own experience where every time that we talk about nutrition in gym class or health class, it's always been like, this will help you lose weight. And, coming from someone like, what do you like? You're telling a class of 30, like 11-year-olds, that they all need to start eating healthy to lose weight. Like, how do
Right.
you know that that's what's best for us? So I think
And you
that's
don't
just.
even know too the history of everybody in the room, right? You're making this huge generalization, but you have no idea what's going on for anybody in that room, right?
Yeah, exactly. I remember I was hospitalized for an eating disorder, anorexia nervosa, like a couple weeks before I started sixth grade. And I remember going into sixth grade, having this health class, and them being like, oh, yeah, it's important that you limit your fats and you make sure that you're exercising enough. And here I am sitting like, I'm not allowed to exercise. Like, who are you telling me that my goal right now is to lose weight? And I remember like going to my parents and being like, okay, this is not gonna work. Like, I need a slip to like sign out of this class.
Yeah,
And I just think it's
exactly.
like so interesting how like no one gave that a second glance. Like, everyone was like, yeah, like, obviously, like, that's normal.
Right,
And I think that's
exactly.
just so sad.
Very much so. It's one of those, it's sad. I think it's horrifying because I've been the practitioner who's writing those notes and who's calling teachers and who's calling principals and saying, you can't do that. You cannot be doing that. I will offer you alternative curriculum if you're willing to teach it. I will talk to your school board, but it's not safe to do those things in the classroom. That has to stop. So I feel for you. And I can't even imagine how awful that would have been for you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like you talked about, like there's so many like difficult conversations when you're trying to like kind of go against what society and diet culture says. Like, you were talking about how you have to have these conversations with your coworkers sometimes. And I've definitely seen that like with my classmates when I have to have lunch and they're talking about, oh yeah, I can't have this like cookie later because I didn't do any exercise today. And me being like, well, like, should I stand up or should I just let that go? And because I know that like there will be difficult conversations if I say like, hey, why are you saying that? Like, you can have the cookie if you want to. So I just love that you bring that up, that like it's hard putting out, I guess, going against the tide is hard.
Yeah, definitely. And it comes with its challenges, it comes with its perks. Sometimes the conversations are really really affirming for folks. Sometimes they don't go anywhere, but I think the important part, and I can't even take credit for it as a sentiment, it's from The Office. When Michael has, I think the whole point is that we keep having these conversations. We keep talking, because if we're not talking about it, then we're ignoring it entirely and we're missing that opportunity to make change. So I
Definitely.
agree.
Yeah, and speaking of like rejecting this weight stigma and the focus on weight, like how have, in your experience, how have your clients responded to this new type of approach to treatment?
Yeah, some have been very appreciative, right? Especially when we're laying out all of the risks and what their alternatives are, right? Instead of pursuing intentional weight loss, what are the health promoting behaviors that we can focus on that we're focusing on growth and progress versus their weight being the end goal? I often like to teach folks that our body weight is kind of like the caboose on a train, that when we put the caboose at the front, in front of the engine, we're going to do some weird things to that train to try and get it to move forward at the risk of pulling the whole thing off the tracks. Our weight, when we put it at the back where a caboose usually goes, it will follow along with all of the other behaviors, our genetics, etc., and it will end up in the state that is the best for it. We don't know what that number is. It might not be where we expected it to be, but it will end up where it belongs, given all of those contexts. And so, in going through that and helping people see the opportunities to grow and progress, I think really appreciated that. Some were kind of surprised because they didn't even realize it was harmful. Again, we're so exposed to diet culture and weight stigma. Social media right now is a minefield for wellness content, weight loss content. We're bombarded with ads and influencers, it's almost impossible to avoid that we expect it to be so normal. So some folks have expressed, oh, like I didn't realize that there was even an alternative, that there would need to be an alternative. So that it was really, really different for them. And then, of course, you get a couple here and there who are pretty frustrated. They're still insistent. You have to, I need you to talk to me about weight loss. I'd really need your support losing weight. I have had, and at the time, I was absolutely gobsmacked. I had two or three patients log out of their session mid-conversation because I walked
Oh,
them through my
wow.
recommendations. And it didn't involve a strict meal plan. And they were so angry about it. And I remember sitting there in front of my blank screen, being like, is that it? Like, is the call over? Like, what was that? It was so odd. It doesn't happen often, thank goodness. And I still get people here and there that they book in and they're requesting weight loss care despite all of the marketing that I do. And I still occasionally will get a doctor who refers someone to me for weight loss, despite all the marketing that I do. So again, it's just continuing to have those conversations. For the most part, I find clients are really appreciative. That's the care type that they're looking for. And even when they express concerns around their body, they very much voice, I don't want to do another diet. I want to focus on improving my health overall, addressing the symptoms, the concerns that I have. My body's going to do what my body's going to do. And so when they hear I work from a non-diet and a weight-inclusive approach, they very much go, okay, great, because that's what I was hoping for. So generally positive.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I love that you talk about like the weight kind of just comes with everything. And it's almost one of those things that you just have to give up control and not let this number define you. And I think I've definitely had that as I've gone through eating disorder recovery, is it's just like I have to just like it's scary to be like, yeah, my body is going to end up at the weight where it wants to end up. And that's scary. It's like, okay, like I don't know where that weight's going to be, and I really want to be able to control that and have influence over it. But at the same time, it's like I don't want to be defined by this number, you know? Like I want to have a life outside of this is my weight today and this is how much I want to lose. So I think that's just a great perspective that you
Absolutely.
have.
And I think that you bring up a really important point that gets missed, right? When our life is chaotic and we have a lot of stressful things happening in the context of an eating disorder, as you and I know, it's about the food, but it's also very much not about the food at all, right? That it makes sense that we're trying to have some sort of feeling of control over what's happening in our lives and to feel that sense of loss of not being able to control that. It can feel terrifying in the initial stages. I find that it's that practice and that constant reassurance to ourselves and from other people that, yeah, you're not defined by this number. You have so many other things that you have now the brain space to do and the time to do. And letting those provide joy, letting those guide what kind of goes on in your life for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So we kind of talked about it a little bit, like social media and diet culture and what they keep telling us. Can you just talk a little bit about how like diet culture is kind of fueling the stress and confusion around weight and eating and body image, and like what are the harmful effects of this?
Absolutely. I think the biggest piece in social media and that stress element of things, and this is huge in my area of work where we look at stress and digestion and pelvic health, menstrual health as well. A big area that I talk about a lot and I get really excited about it is called neurogastroenterology. It's a study of the way the nervous system and the digestive system talk to each other. And we have similar nerves that can impact pain response in the gut and in the reproductive system. And more research is building in this particular area. High levels of stress from a variety of different elements, good and bad stress, right? Good stress being lots of big, exciting competitions coming up. I'm a competitive figure skater still to this day. And when I work with higher level athletes, that anticipation and excitement of tournament, or bad stress of, a family member's been really ill or illness in themselves. very much implicated in the development and the exacerbation of pain, and modifies the way that the digestive system is actually moving and the gut microbiome composition. So we found there was a study in 2022 by Barazanji et al. And found that the insular cortex, which is the area of the brain that does interoceptive awareness, has alterations in structure and function, especially in populations with more chronic interoceptive visceral pain, meaning their body's labeling and identifying of pain in the body. The insular cortex is how we respond to danger or identify danger. Other studies in 2020, 2021 found the same things around central sensitization, where the nervous system is overactivated and increases our sensitivity to internal and external conditions. I'm currently actually in the process of working to study the relationship between altered eating habits and food beliefs and the experience of endometriosis, and come up with a new screening tool to actually identify patients with endo who might be at risk for disordered eating or an eating disorder. From a social media perspective, social media is, again, we're being bombarded with information, with ads, with just content, right? I don't know how many times in a day I pass by a video, let me be your new insert here content creator. Let me be your new, your go-to. You must buy this. Did you see this? This was fire. I loved this. Have you seen? Did you hear? Everything expects our attention always. Our nervous system is lit up like a Christmas tree. And as a result, not only are we responding with our fight or flight or freeze responses, right? We're holding steady thinking, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm just so overwhelmed with information. But our digestive system is altered because our digestive system isn't thinking, hey, you know what? I would love to absorb some vitamin D here. Or, hey, you know what? Probably time to have a bowel movement, right? If we're hiding in the back of the cave and we hear a predator, we're not thinking about chewing a stalk of celery, right? It makes too much noise. The predator's going to hear us and then we have a problem. So our digestive system turns down, our reproductive system is impacted, and then our bodies are fatigued and inflamed. We're tired, we're sore, and we're burnt out. So, as much as I love social media for its connections and spreading information, there almost comes a point of how much of the social media interaction is actually supportive, how much of it is actually creating community, and how much of it is more inflammatory, how much of it is actually worsening some of the symptoms that are going on, support groups or things where you get kind of a vacuum, right, of information. I would say that that's my biggest take on social media. I love it, but I also kind of hate it.
Yeah, it's definitely like a balancing act of noticing like, okay, like this is the helpful stuff and this is the things that I want on my feed, and then noticing like, okay, this post is not helpful to me, and like, okay, it's been an hour, like we can put the phone down. And I think like
Exactly.
sometimes these messages can be so deceiving. I know that like social media, like I don't know, like diet culture being in like what I eat in a days and body checks being so like progress checks, like I'm trying to give inspiration when like really for someone who has experiences like me or you, like it's very clear like, okay, this is probably not helpful and this is, you know, gonna cause more harm later in the day. So I think it's one of those things where you really have to like think about like what is the point of this post and is this actually serving me?
Absolutely. And the what I eat in a days are particular sticky points for myself as a dietitian and as a person with my own disordered eating disorder history, that when a what I eat in a day video shows examples of meals and it doesn't include the body check and it doesn't include the nutrition information, they can be kind of helpful to see, oh, okay, that's what a snack kind of looks like. Or, ooh, you know what? I never thought about putting those two ingredients together. That sounds really good. As soon as there's a body check, I'm immediately swiping. I'm like, nope, I'm not interested. Immediately, I'm not interested. Or I'm marking it as not interested. I know social media has gotten better at allowing filtering of certain types of content where you can put some of those keywords into a filter out. I know there is more and more protections that are gradually building to try and remove or eliminate some of that content. It's slow going because there are just so many people using it, often with more than one social media account. So it's a lot to undertake. And I appreciate that social media makes people a lot of money. But it is one of those, yeah, it is the content actually useful or actually inspiring, or is this just fueling the flame of, poor body image and dysfunctional eating habits? Definitely.
Well, speaking of useful social media, I saw on your Instagram post one that I really liked about the myth around like detoxing and the toxicity of certain foods. I think this is such a craze right now with like, oh, drink this green juice or this lemon water in the morning to do a detox. Could you break down like why beliefs like if you can't pronounce it, like you shouldn't eat it because it's toxic, are like
Yeah,
misleading for people?
definitely. Now, this is probably one of my favorite big picture questions to talk about because, like most things, very rarely is it just one singular cause. We've got a big mess of things. One of them is the impact of healthism, which is the expectation of the individual to be solely responsible for their health and often ties in with the belief that more expensive is better. So we have this pressure on people to be the only person who's responsible for what happens to their bodies, and then a lack of understanding of food, right? A lot of our education and nutrition has been defunded or it's just not valued. And then on top of that, we experience naturally more fear, more worry about the things we don't recognize or understand. So when we're given health or nutrition information, if we're not really sure about it, and there's the pressure to just, we'll just do it this way, and then you won't have this thing happen to you. Really easy for us to fall into that. We also have to speak to, really low food and health literacy, right? If there's a poor understanding of the food system and how it works, accessing and actually understanding health information, not just the pamphlets that you get at a doctor's office or at a specialist's office, but being able to read and understand the signs about washing your hands, even, or advertisements in the grocery store. A lot of frustration comes up for folks too around poor healthcare access. We often have long wait times to see just your family doctor and potentially feeling pressure to pay out of pocket for private services, especially with that kind of two pathway model. On top of it, we also have a food industry that doesn't value its employees and the working conditions or their consumers. So they're not very good at, clarifying information. They run with whatever's trendy. They use the same terms, and that kind of builds to that feeling of legitimacy. Really poor understanding of food science and how compounds are used. Like vitamin C is ascorbic acid. That's its chemical name. Caffeine has a big long one. It's 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine. I consume a couple cups of that maybe a day, but we don't
I was
call
about to
it
say that would be a
that.
lot less sexy if they put that on the
Exactly. Starbucks 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine to start your day, right? We don't use those terms. We use more common ones. So of course it sounds scary when we use the big word because we don't know it by that word. We have this huge surge of influencer culture, right? Companies use influencers because they seem a little bit more realistic versus, supermodels or celebrities to convince consumers of purchasing a product. And influencers, as a result, can potentially use a power dynamic to give that illusion of knowing better and sometimes expertise, right? If we have doctors or chiropractors, nurses, dietitians, even, who use that expertise to influence people to purchase products from them. We have in more recent years the rage bait to encourage more engagement and sharing, and that boosted in the algorithm. More people see it, and the more we see it, the more we feel like it's legitimate. We believe it. If our influencers don't have great education levels to begin with, if they're probably, trying to use data or documents to prove a point, but they actually haven't read them. or understanding them, right? When you see an influencer showing a study, if you were to actually pull it up, there's a really good chance that it's a rat study. It's not in humans, which is a completely different ball game when it comes to research. Or they're using a popular one I see is European regulations which are based on different criteria compared to North American regulations. It doesn't mean one is better than the other. There's just simply different rules based on the country. And the final big thing being end stage capitalism on our food and supplement marketing, right? We are now beyond the point of selling a product to people. We're now selling information and storage or access of information, right? At-home tests that determine the supplements you should take based on your genetics from a spit test you do, or an app that tracks your cycle and tells you what to eat, or artificial intelligence summarizing these broad swaths of potentially inaccurate nutrition information or giving inaccurate nutrition information. So a lot of the myths around detoxing and toxicity are less about actually concerning, food quality and food safety, and more so this overarching societal devaluing of food and science education that trickles down to impact populations really negatively and leaving them fearful of the foods that they eat.
So what would you say, what are like the first steps to like kind of breaking down these barriers? What would you in a utopia, what would be your first steps?
I would say if I was to look back and even, speaking to a younger me around, how do you cultivate a social media community that's based on, science and accurate information? I would probably eliminate anybody from my following that uses really strong all or nothing, black and white kind of phrases, right? That if you have this, then you will automatically have this, those causal kind of statements there. That would probably be the first thing to go. I've been more critical in the last few months, more specifically of brands that use popular terminology, right? We use clean ingredients and we use non-GMO. I've gotten more critical around, no, you know what? That's not a company that I'm going to support if they're taking advantage of a population that doesn't really understand how those terms are used. I'm not interested in spending my energy or my money with those companies. Overall, I try to limit the celebrities that I follow because I know that they are under so much incredible pressure to do things with their bodies, with their time, with their routines, that they're not realistic people to follow. And the photos that they get done are after how many hours of makeup and hair. And they have the chef and they have the trainer and they have the driver and they have all of the things that your typical person doesn't. So I limit overall my exposure to that content. And I try to keep that in mind when I do have a couple here and there that I do follow. I Lady Gaga, I must absolutely love. I'm still very cognizant of those same kind of factors. And then I try very much to encourage of my patients, my clients, of myself, my friends and family, following the organizations that are using evidence-based information to share and that are not just trained in providing care around those concerns, but are also trained in how to provide education in those areas. Planned Parenthood is probably one of my favorite organizations to encourage folks to follow because it's not just a matter of they know what they're talking about. They know how to talk about it with you so that it's easy to understand. And organizations that want people to learn use those type of techniques. They use those strategies so that their content is easy to understand and easy to make decisions with. So those would probably be the big steps. And then, of course, anybody that you follow that makes you feel not great about your body or your life or your food probably not somebody that's worth your time or your likes. So those can also go in the bin.
Yeah, that comparison piece is just so important. And it's so easy, like right now, to say, oh, yeah, don't compare yourself to these people because you don't know how many hours or how many photos they took. But then, like, when you're sitting in that moment with that photo in front of you, that's really hard. It's your brain automatically goes to, oh my gosh, look at how perfect their life looks like. So I think it sounds so easy and it's definitely so difficult. So I would say it's so important to be like proactive in doing that.
Absolutely, definitely. And I think it's more so the emphasis on proactive as much as you can, gentle returning to a center of sorts when you catch yourself. Because even to this day, I catch myself in that imposter syndrome, in that comparison, between other dietitians, some of them in areas that are not mine, but feeling like, oh gosh, look how successful they are in this area, or at least looks like they're super successful. Gosh, I wish that was me. Or when I engage with other adult competitive figure skaters, and I'm thinking, look at how much ice time that they get. Like, I wish I had access to that. Like, that's incredible. And then that just translates to making me feel less worthy of what I do, which, no, I work hard to do what I do and I'm happy with what I do. I don't know anything about them, but I can gently bring myself back to that reminder of, you know what? Yes, we can recognize we're only human. We can feel all those feelings. We can still prioritize what we are doing and getting joy out of what our lives look like. So doing that little bit of both is really important.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I also love the fact that you bring up like comparison isn't just about bodies, too. I think it's also about like anything. Like, I know being a teenage in high school, like college admissions is a really big thing right now as I'm in
Oh,
junior
yeah.
year and there's so I go to a pretty big public high school, so there's so much competition of like this is my grades and these are the classes that I'm taking and like this is the research that I'm doing and it's like it's really easy to like feel overwhelmed and like you do with other nutritionists or other figure skaters. Yeah, it's just so easy to be like, wow, I'm so behind. And I think for me, what's really helped is just realizing like I'm doing everything I can and everything in my power. And then just also making sure that like you enjoy life. Like I think my mom is really good at that. Whenever I tell her, she's always like, that's great, but like, are you enjoying your life? Like, are you doing this just so
Are
you
you
can compete?
having any fun?
Exactly. And I think it's like one of those like, sometimes I feel like a 5-year-old when she says that, but it is like an important question of like, I mean, I hope that when I'm like dying, I'm not remembered like, oh yeah, I beat this person. I was a better like figure skater or a better runner than this one person. Like, no. Like it feels like a big deal right
Exactly.
now, but so I think that
Absolutely.
perspective is just so important.
Definitely.
And then another one of your posts that I really liked was this concept of mechanical eating. When hunger cues may be off. I know that I've had a lot of experience with this. Having an eating disorder, it's really hard being told like, oh, intuitive eating, like time to follow your hunger cues when like, I haven't eaten normally in like years. Like I don't remember what that's like and my hunger cues aren't there yet because my body doesn't trust me yet. So can you just explain like your philosophy behind this and like when is mechanical eating helpful?
Absolutely. So, mechanical eating is essentially, for folks who aren't familiar, eating in a very mechanical or robotic fashion almost. So, it looks like very specific times to eat, sometimes is even very specific amounts. And in the context of eating disorder recovery, can be an incredible tool to make sure that a person is nutritionally rehabilitated and can more appropriately meet their needs. But I also use it in other areas of nutrition work. Essentially, mechanical eating allows for a baseline of regular and adequate eating that can begin to support those energy needs in early recovery. Those needs can sometimes be a lot higher than we anticipated, and so it's a good place to start and then build from. And with other digestive health concerns as well, create some stability. I commonly see this in my practice with co-occurring reproductive health concerns, that we're kind of supporting that pattern of digestive stimulation, helping someone be more comfortable with those sensations. It also builds a lot of exposure to more appropriate amounts of food, especially if someone is recovering from an eating disorder or disordered eating, right? What does a normal quote unquote snack look like? What does a normal quote unquote meal look like? And also works when there's concerns around volume eating, right? What does a normal amount of food look like for typical digestive function? And I would say from that, neuro gastroenterology approach as well, mechanical eating can sometimes create that reconnection, allowing the brain and the digestive system to rewire and rebuild those, natural hunger and fullness cues over time. Like you said, building that trust to experience them. And I like to put a bit of a disclaimer on it as well, because this has come up often as a question. Natural hunger and fullness cues may or may not be the end point for somebody. They might continue to need timing and reminding, practices permanently, and that's okay. The goal is what strategy helps the person get fed on a consistent basis and to their needs. If that is permanently mechanical eating or some sort of modified mechanical eating approach, great. If that's intuitive eating, great. Whatever gets the person fed is so best, but it creates more capacity to begin feeling those cues if that's where the person is going to end up in the long run.
I love that individualistic perspective because I think, especially with the word like health and like influencers online, it's like this is the way that you get healthy. If you follow my exercise routine and you follow what I eat every day, like you're gonna be healthy. When like actually like genetics play a part, your schedule plays a part, like your socioeconomic status plays a part. Like there's so many different factors. So I love that approach that you take, like eating and any part of your life isn't gonna look the same for anyone. And I just think that's so important to recognize because I think, like we talked about before, there's so much advice that is just put to everyone and say like, okay, this is the general advice that we're gonna give to every single buddy without considering that you might have individual needs. So I love that you bring
Exactly.
that up.
Amazing. Yay.
So one thing that I would now love to get into is just something specifically about like menstrual health. And I think this is just so important because as a young person, especially as a female, I feel like I don't know a lot about my body. And I think that's just so sad that like in schools and I don't know, in sports teams that like I haven't got educated on this menstrual cycle, and the only thing that I know is like, oh, it comes every month and it's really important for your reproduction. And then the conversation stops there. It's like, we have this conversation in fifth grade, and then we come back and it's like, okay, now we're not going to talk about this word periods again. So my first question is, can you break down what polycystic ovary syndrome is? And yeah, just break it down for us because I know that I wasn't aware of this before I started researching you.
Definitely. Yeah. So polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS for short, is essentially a condition where the ovaries have difficulty ovulating, and it's related to both hormonal and metabolic alterations. Periods generally become quite irregular or they stop entirely, and the body's ability to use energy can be negatively impacted. And that's more so via blood sugar and insulin function that's impacted. Because of both the hormonal and the metabolic side effects and consequences of PCOS, folks with PCOS generally have an increased risk for other conditions like heart disease, diabetes, type 2, more specifically, and osteoporosis. And on top of that, an area that doesn't get talked about enough is an increased risk of disordered eating due to weight stigma. While we don't use weight as a diagnostic criteria for PCOS, many folks find that their body changes and gains weight with PCOS. And because of all of those influences that we've talked about today, it can be very easy and common for doctors to blame weight on PCOS and focus on weight specifically as the marker of success. Not really looking at are periods back to normal or how does blood sugar look and with some of the mental health consequences that might come up, like depression or anxiety, is a person accessing care that helps them to feel better? And so weight stigma can be a huge challenge that folks might experience as well in PCOS. The biggest goals when it comes to PCOS care is ensuring that periods are occurring in a way that suits that person. If that means we're suppressing periods because a person's not interested in having a period and they're not interested in having babies, cool. Do we have something that's helping them do that successfully? And do we have supports in place to reduce the risks of diabetes, heart disease? And that's often where nutrition comes in, and using that non-diet approach truly gives them more of that autonomy around, here's how I can take really good care of myself and let my weight do what my weight's going to do in the process of that. So that's what PCOS looks like in really simple terms.
I love that. And I love that you break that down because that's something that I was just unaware of. And I just think, again, it's so important that, as young women, like we do have these conversations and we can say, okay, like let's talk about periods and let's talk about like what it means when your period becomes irregular and what could be the underlying cause. Now, another condition
Absolutely.
that I'd love to talk about is endometriosis. So could you break that one down for us too?
Absolutely. And this is one that I work in a lot. So I feel very well versed in being able to define this one for you. Not that I see the others any less, but this one is particularly prominent. So endometriosis is a condition where tissue that is similar to the uterine lining, so it's not the uterine lining, it's similar to it, starts to grow outside of the uterus, so impacting the fallopian tubes, the ovaries. And if you didn't know this, you will after today. The reproductive system is not closed off to the rest of the body because the ovaries and the fallopian tubes are not directly connected. The fallopian tubes are open to the pelvis so that an egg can leave an ovary and be swept into it, but it's otherwise open to the pelvis. And so we can potentially have what we call endometriosis lesions and inflammatory compounds that can leave the reproductive system and land in other parts of the pelvis. It can
Oh,
affect
interesting.
even other structures outside of the pelvis, like the diaphragm or the lungs, the rest of the digestive system, in rare cases in the brain as well. We found that endometriosis almost behaves more like cancer cells in the way that it grows. It's very much not cancer, but the way that it proliferates is similar. So those lesions can produce their own hormones, they produce their own inflammatory compounds, and they start to affect the structure of other tissues. So if we have endometriosis in and around the bladder and the bowels, that inflammation can over time create adhesions that stick those tissues together, and now they don't move very well, which can cause a lot of pain. What I wish people knew more about endometriosis is that it's not just period pain. Endometriosis is a whole body condition. And some people have no period pain at all, but very significant endometriosis, and others have very, very significant pain, but very, very mild endo. So we have to look at it as a whole person condition, and given its association with other autoimmune conditions like, celiac disease and potentially thyroid conditions and the digestive side effects, it's very important that we expand our understanding as a reproductive system, a menstrual health starting point. But that needs to be much like the birth canal, the starting point for our understanding of endo and growing into seeing the whole person as affected by endo in some capacity or another.
I love that you bring up the fact that the reproductive system is open because I feel like when we learn about it in school, we learn about it as like this is just like a part of you and it's like closed and like you don't see it connected to your whole body. So for me, that's just super interesting to talk about that
Exactly.
because yeah, I know that in every single diagram that I've ever been shown about the reproductive system, it's like okay, like this is where your ovaries are, this is where your fallopian tube is, and like This is just a little cute
Yeah.
system here.
Exactly. We see them as like attached to each other, right? The ovary is stuck to the end of the fallopian tubes. And you'll also see in textbooks, the reproductive system is shown flat. So the ovaries are along the side. Inside the human body, the ovaries are more so tucked in front. So it actually
Oh,
sits a little bit
interesting.
more closed. So a really good visual is almost like a butterfly, that we see it as if it's a butterfly with the wings open. In the human body, it's more like a butterfly with the wings closed as actual
Oh,
anatomy.
interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that just comes back to the fact that there's such like a big gap in that education and that like we don't even know our own bodies very well. And I think that would just be so helpful if that education could start at a younger age because it is so amazing what our bodies can do when you think about it. And I think that kind of goes into my next period of I'd love to just dive into the idea of like why periods are like powerful and why they are something that we should celebrate because I think that it can be a very stigmatized topic of like, oh, hush, hush, I'm getting my period right now, or like having concerns about your period can be like nervous to talk about them. So I'd love to just like dive into like why are you so passionate about periods and why do you think that they should be something that we celebrate rather than like push off to the side?
Totally. So historically, periods were very much seen as this source of shame that you should hide them. You know, nobody should know that you're bleeding, hide it, you know, throw the sheets in the wash and change your clothes and hide it as much as you can. In the modern era, more specifically within fertility and gender affirming care as well, periods might even feel like a failure. Right? If I have a period, it means that I don't match the identity that I am. Or I had a period, which means my fertility treatment failed and I'm not pregnant again and I feel awful about it. And I think that much like reclaiming the terms and the experiences of other things, I think seeing our periods as a source of power is a beautiful shift to work our way into, right? That practice element, I think, is huge. Our periods tell us so much about the health of our bodies, right? That fifth vital sign that we can understand them and care for our bodies better, and better acknowledging that we're human. We do have needs. We do have to care for them. We are allowed to care for them. When we're feeling more fatigued before a period, we are allowed to rest and modify our training. Or if we experience these big dramatic changes in you know, our moods, if we find, you know, now I'm really social, or especially for younger populations too, that increased interest or thinking about sex, that like our brain is changing in a cycle. We use our periods and that whole menstrual cycle as a way to learn about how our body and our brain work. And that's not something to ever be ashamed of. We're learning, and we get to take back more control over how we experience periods as well, right? If someone chooses to take a birth control or use an IUD so they don't have to have a bleeding period so that they can focus on lots of other things in their life, that's incredible for them and for folks who choose how they'd like to experience bleeding, right? Do they use pads and tampons? Do they use menstrual cups? Do they use period underwear? There's a lot that we can reclaim as things to have agency over. And I think that starting to see our periods as less of an inconvenience and more of a body message is a really fantastic thing to start working towards.
I love that. And I think I know that this conversation has gone longer than I told you it would, but this has been so interesting for me. Again, like I just feel like this information just isn't like easily accessible for young people, and we're not given it, even though I definitely think we should. So I just want to thank you so much for like coming on and talking to me. And I know I took you over longer than what I said, but this has
Totally
been
okay.
so amazing for me. And I am so excited to like continue following your work. And I mean, your Instagram is so informative, and it will definitely be in the show notes because I think everyone should check it out and they will learn so much.
Fantastic. It has been an absolute pleasure, right? The environment might not fund menstrual health education very well, and there's a lot of political and sociological, societal expectations of how we talk about menstrual health. What I will say as kind of a final message to folks is it only ever benefits anybody else other than you to not learn about your period. Take something back for yourself. Learn about your period. Talk about your period. Take it back.
I love that, and I think that's a great note. So thank you so much.
You are so sorry.